and welcome back to Failure Piece Theater. I am your amiable co-host, Tim, and joining me as always is...
Catherine. Excuse me. I've been sick. Yeah, I've been sick.
Man, it's the heat's going, and it's dried out my sinuses, and I wake up every morning and just kind of cough myself to death. It's great. Getting old is great, and breathing badly is also great. At least... that's what we here in America have told ourselves.
Yep.
And, you know, 9 out of 10 doctors agree. That's what I've heard. That's what I've seen. So I think it's all right. But yes, we have returned, coughs and all, to discuss yet another film. I don't know about you, but I think it's been a pretty banger year for small horror films.
It has.
I'm not going to say that anything else in 2023 has been good, because most of it has not been good. But a lot of the horror films being released right now, pretty okay, not too bad. At least I feel like I've had a good year of watching horror films. Right, we've had some big swings. Right, we had our Evil Dead Rise earlier in the year. We got our long anticipated Saw sequel again, maybe.
Yay.
Which was not a big film, it was marketed big. We got The Boogeyman, which we were just talking about, Stephen King adaptation of one of his Night Shift stories, that was pretty good. Obviously, we already talked about Cobweb on this fine program, which was pretty good. And then, you know, the... And then in October, you know, Five Nights at Freddy's just came in and kicked all the doors down and started little animatronics just flipping you off in every corner, and proceeded to make just all the money. Have you seen the Five Nights at Freddy's film?
No, yet? Because I only recently learned what those games are about. You would never know that I work in the games industry with how little I know about video games. But yeah, I just learned about Five Nights at Freddy's. And it's only been like a year since I learned what Fortnite is. And I don't know.
All these things are for the best.
Yeah.
Really.
I don't feel like it enriched my life in any way now that I know about Five Nights at Freddy's. But
Five Nights at Freddy's is a brilliant examination of what can happen when you put as little as possible in your game in regards to lore. Like when you, it's a testament to the, let your audience fill in the gaps. Right. And, you know, Scott Cawthon, you know, I obviously have issues with some of his political leanings. It's fine. I'm not the person that says, well, I disagree with you, therefore I can't enjoy the things you create necessarily. But I think he figured out early on, and probably just as a nature of the scale of the project that he was making with the original Five Nights, that less is more. It's just less is more. You don't have to fill it to the brim with stuff, and that's okay. And so I love that the lore has basically been crafted by the community. Like he's engaged with it, and he has, you know, crafted it, of course. But I will say I was surprised by the film. I thought it was much better than I was expecting it to be, which, again, my expectations were quite low. So that's not really that's a backhanded compliment at best.
My expectations are in the basement. I don't.
If you're in the basement, I would say you would be safe getting onto the third or fourth step up from the basement, and you'd probably still think it was all right. It's really okay.
It's the Chuck E. Cheese monsters, right?
It's, yes. Really, it's more showbiz pizza monsters. And
right.
I know that's a subtle distinction.
But we're Americans here, so there is a distinction.
There is a distinction. Showbiz pizza was the one that had the ensemble rock band.
Yeah, where it was like, how do we take country bears and make it traumatizing?
Precisely. Nolan Bushnell went to Disney, said, I want this in a pizza parlor. Do it. And then he paid for it until that happened. And so it's very much that. And I totally know where it came from. And you do too, because as a fan of those, brave souls out there doing urban exploring, there was a Reddit thread, and honestly, I believe the original thread was on the Something Awful forums, of somebody busting into one of the Showbiz Pizza Palaces that had just been shut down, right? They didn't empty it. They didn't demo it. They just locked the doors and ditched, right? And they went into one of those places and they took pictures of these animatronics in these terrifying states, right? The foam latex had, mm-hmm. you know, peeled off the faces. The animatronics were broken. There were
it
pieces.
Inspired creepypastas for the next decade.
100%, right? That was part of that chain of events. And I know that Cawthon, being, I'm sure he was as online as anybody else in that period.
Maybe more so.
Saw that. Maybe more so, possibly. And I'm sure he used that as some inspiration. Now, he's taken it in a very different direction, but that idea of what if these animatronics meant to be fun, family-friendly entertainment?
What if Country Bear but evil?
Right. You know, what would that look like? And, you know, by God, he's turned it into millions and millions and millions of dollars. So go for it, man. Yeah. Best of luck. But the film was okay. I enjoyed it. I thought I thought PETA did a great job. Josh Hutcherson was out there just Hutchersoning it. He seems like a very good guy. I'm glad that he's had a hit because I feel like his performance in the Hunger Games films, which was quite good for the most part. I mean, his character is kind of annoying.
You had to say Hunger Games before I even knew what you were talking about. Like, who is
you didn't realize, you Josh didn't remember that he was Tita the Baker in
Hutcherson.
It's not Hutchinson, it's Hutcherson. It's different. Future Man was fun on Hulu. That was a good show. I only watched the first season, but it was all right. You know, like, I'm glad he had a hit on his hands. And, you know, the film itself, although it sounds like Cawthon was like probably over involved as the creator / producer, apparently had like tremendous veto power over everything. You know, he hit a formula that works. The main thing that makes it work for me, and I was talking about this with somebody the other day, is the animatronics are stellar. Like, they are excellent, and they are excellent because they're Henson animatronics. They're all made by Jim Henson Company.
That's cool.
And they did a bang up job. The puppet performers inside of them are incredible. The suits themselves are perfect, not only in looking like the games, but also in the way in which they move their faces. Like, it's everything that you would expect from the Henson Creature Shop.
What kind of a weird things. Psychopath am I that you've been talking about this movie and I'm like, and then you say puppets and I'm like, ooh.
I know.
Sounds right? Cool.
It's
tell me more
cool.
About these puppets.
And they're great. Like, they're really, really solid. And I think that, and if anything, that was the thing they had to nail. Because if that stuff didn't look good, the movie just would not work. But since they do, you can kind of forgive the rest of the failings. And there are some. But I know one thing that surprised, you know, my family, especially my wife, who's not a horror person. We've talked about that before. She does not enjoy horror films in the traditional sense. Every once in a while, if it's a really good one.
It has been fun to watch them with her, though, because she is like kind of in another place. So she just views those movies differently.
Right. It's a really good perspective for somebody like me who just watches all of this trash.
Yeah.
And so I watch one that's like decent. And I'm like, oh, that was great. Nice. You know, it didn't have like a complete failure of the script in Act 3, you know, kind of thing. But the thing that they do, you know, again, with the very sort of sparing lore of the Five Nights at Freddy's games, we don't really know anything about the original security guard in the first game, which, you know, is ostensibly the main character of this film, is that security guard and his Five Nights at Freddy's, right? You get it? it's a thing. But so this one, they kind of give him a backstory and tie him in with some of the lore elements that are present in some of the later games. Like, and it all kind of works. And Hutcherson does a good job of portraying that guy. Basically, he was young, like 10 or 12, and his brother was kidnapped, and he carries all this guilt because he was like the one responsible for watching him while they were on this family trip. And so now he attempts to do lucid dreaming every night to try and go back into his memories via his dreams to remember details about the event in the hopes of figuring out what might have happened to his brother because he was never found. And so it's a nice little like hook for the character to sort of like, why is he doing this? And then his reason for taking this, you know, obviously fucked up job is that his family sort of disintegrated post his brother's disappearance. And he is now left being, he's now left responsible for his much younger sister. Like she's like 11 or 12 and he's, you know, in his 20s or early 30s. And so he has to work in order to support her. Otherwise his crazy aunt played by Mary Stuart Masterson of all people, is going to steal her to try and take like the government check that comes along with her from her parents' death. And it's a weird little side plot, but it's enough motivation that you kind of understand. So, Clever, it's another Jason Blum production. So
aren't they all
Bloomed it up and he said, here's $20 million. Can make your little fucking movie. I don't care what you do. I'll spend $30 million to market the shit. We're going to sell it to Peacock for $20 million so that I got all my money back immediately. And we're going to release this bitch. And then they made like $300 million. So
yay.
Look forward to more Five Nights at Freddy's. If we don't have Five Nights at Freddy's : sister location by this coming October, they will have fucked up.
Huh. Well,
but I imagine they will.
Put in your bets now.
It's been a good year for horror. Five Nights at Freddy's was solid. The Pope's Exorcist, that Russell Crowe movie, it wasn't bad.
That's the one Russell Crowe speaking in a on the little Vespa scooter, wasn't it?
Yes, and he speaks in a bad Italian accent for pretty much the whole thing for no reason. Scream 6 was okay. I finally did catch up and watch that. The Scream franchise hit me at just the right time where I'm always going to have a special place for it, right? It's always going to be special. But I don't like that these new ones, there is just no way to figure out who the killers are until the end and they reveal it. Like there's no clues. Like in the first movie, if you go back and watch it and their interactions and what people say, you can see the seeds of who the bad guys are. Yeah. Right. In these new ones, like there's just nothing, right? You don't know anything until they pop that mask off at the end and go, it's me. Right?
What? Yeah. That, it's the Scooby-Doo effect. It's old man Withers.
You know, it was him all along, wasn't it? You know, it's just like,
when I was 12, this is a little embarrassing. Not really. When I was 12, I thought it would be really funny to make my own short film making fun of how many more of these Scream movies can they make? And I settled on Scream 4 for my fake Scream movie, thinking they'll never make it to a fourth one. Surely someone will step in and say, nah. And now that they've made 6 of them, I'm like, well, I learned my lesson there. I would give anything to see that sketch. I labored over it because I had like a mask, I had like a fake knife, and I somehow talked our cousin into letting me murder her like 4 or 5 different times in this short film. But yeah, I thought Scream 4 was ridiculous.
Yeah, couldn't possibly extend this joke longer than that. Right?
They'll be out of ideas by the fourth one. Come on. And Here we are. There was also that Talk to Me movie. Did you see that?
I did see Talk to Me. Yes, that is one that is not. It got a lot of attention initially, but the talk has kind of fallen off, which I think is unfortunate. I did enjoy Talk to Me quite a bit. It's very brash. It's very bold.
I struggled with that movie.
It's not an easy film to watch. The violence is very,
and
very dark.
I dealt with that until the boy.
Yeah.
And the brutalizing of a child. And like an actor who is perceptibly a child to me.
Mm-hmm. Like yeah, that's like the he one. He does not read as an older person playing.
Yeah, like
a kid.
That's the benefit of teenagers dying in these horror movies is the teenagers. They're played by 25-year-olds, so like they look like adults, they act like adults, and I don't I don't feel bad when bad things happen to them. But, oh my God, I actually had to pause the movie and get up and leave the room over some of those scenes. Cause I'm like, you just, that's a child, and you're just hurting a child, and it's horrible to watch. That was it. Like I did okay with the rest of the movie, but man, that was almost too much for me.
It's a rough one. And it's worth noting that it's YouTubers. It's the Raka Raka guys who have made a career out of like flinging themselves onto tables, like old school wrestling style. Like these guys know how to film and perpetrate violence on characters, right? Some real, most of it obviously very fake and assisted with technology and special effects and visual effects. But the violence in that film, it's also brutal, and they don't pan away, right? We talked in with the last film that, you know, you the original Saw, you don't see as much violence as you remember seeing. In this one, you see everything. Like it is incredibly brutal. And it doesn't really stop once it starts. Like there's just sort of consistent complex violence pretty much the whole time. And it is a lot. It is really a lot. It has a sort of It Follows plot, you know, whereas It Follows, you know, the whole thing can be viewed as like a big sort of horror infused look at STDs. This is like drug use, you know, via spirituality, sort of the same idea. But ultimately, I think it is very good. I'm excited to see what they do with a sequel, which apparently is already in the works. Because I think there is room there to explore sort of what they're doing in terms of this, you know, like how the ghosts interact with people and whatever. But yeah, it was hard. It was hard.
Yeah.
It lacked any of this modern horror in a lot of ways, even though it is more violent than ever, is also kind of more sanitized. It's played differently than it used to be. Like watching the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre is still like a really disturbing experience, you know. Watching any of the horror sequels, which have, you know, more advanced gore effects, more advanced prosthetic effects, it doesn't matter. They don't hit the same. And Talk to Me was like a little bit more of that for me, I think.
I enjoyed it otherwise. And like I said, I'm almost impressed with a movie that can get me to that point, because it's not easy. I'm very much like a believer in, this is movie magic. None of this is real. That's what movie magic. You know, like I'm a big believer in that. I think that, you know, you can handle most things that happen in a film if you just remember that, like, these are actors, these are trained professionals, these are stuntmen.
Yeah, everybody's fine.
Nobody's everybody's prepared. Having a great time. You know, if you look at behind the scenes photographs from most horror movies, you know, you see these actors are having a good time. But yeah, that was particularly difficult. But otherwise, the movie
scene
was
in
great.
Particular is rough. Oh. There is another one later, I guess, in the bathroom at the hospital.
Yeah.
That one's hard too. It's shorter, but it's brutal. I think it also, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but most of the harm inflicted in this film is self-harm. In Talk to Me, it's people injuring themselves. And I think that puts another layer on it, right? Where they are doing harm to their own bodies rather than having harm being done. That does add another layer of, you know, it's tough. But yeah, so again, we say all that, we do that little like mini horror film review of the year to talk about another one. In this case, No One Will Save You, a lovely little horror film released on Hulu this year exclusively, as far as I can tell. And from a sort of frequent flyer of our podcast, one Mr. Brian Duffield, who, primarily known as a writer, has gotten into directing for his last couple of projects. He did the script, at least the initial script, for Underwater, which we reviewed a while back, the Kristen Stewart underwater horror film, which was pretty solid. One that I did, we do Love and Monsters on this podcast? I absolutely cannot remember.
We have not.
Okay, we talked about it. But a film that I really liked a couple of years ago, starring the Maze Runner's own Dylan O'Brien, called Love and Monsters, which the film that came out apparently was not, it wasn't really Duffield's script. It was The Big Strokes, but they had done heavy revision to it, which seems like is a pretty common refrain with a lot of Duffield's writing work. He kind of writes the initial script, lays out that work, then hands it off, and then it gets, you know, once the project's picked up and directors attached, they kind of do their own thing with it. But Duffield, you know, is a multi-blacklist writer, right? Several of his films have wound up on the blacklist, including the script for Jane's Got a Gun, which is an older Natalie Portman-helmed Western that had a lot of fans at the time. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I don't want to comment on it because I barely remember it, but I don't remember disliking it when I saw it. It was kind of that mini Western renaissance we had there at the late, in the early 2010s. Mm. But so a great writer by all accounts, and a fairly successful one who has now moved into writer-director role. He did direct another film before this one called Spontaneous, based on a YA novel. Have you seen anything about this? I've never seen it, but I've put it on the back burner. I want to watch it now. It is about children who explode.
Oh,
right. Like they just
spontaneous human combustion.
Yeah.
Oh,
So it is called Spontaneous, and it follows, it's Catherine Langford, the one from 13 Reasons Why, and Charlie Plummer from Moonfall.
Oh, the moon's helping us.
Moonfall. Yeah. The moon is helping us. It's always helping us. But it looks very solid, but it was a pandemic film. It came out the year of the pandemic in October and just got buried like everything else did. So again, so we say all that to say Duffield, pretty solid performer in terms of you know, these kinds of projects. And as I think we'll find, I liked this one quite a bit. So No One Will Save You is... a Hulu release, but it's got a lot going on. It's kind of cool. It stars Caitlin as Deaver. I don't really know how to say her last name.
I want to say it's Deaver. That's my feeling, but I don't know.
Sounds right.
Makes sense. Anyway, sounds real.
That sounds plausible. But at the very least, this is almost a bottle picture. It's really about this Deaver's character in her house in the woods, facing off against a threat. We'll say at this point, we won't give away the whole game. But this movie is excellent, and you'll pick up on it immediately. I realized about 10 minutes in what was happening. Probably shouldn't have taken me that long, but this girl that we're following in this film is totally isolated from the world around her for reasons that are explained throughout the film. Nobody really wants to associate with her. No one talks with her. And so this is a film that has no dialogue. It contains zero lines of dialogue, presumably apart from, you know, like that kind of stuff. But there is one spoken line in the film. Right?
There's a lot of people about to talk.
Yes,
the movie is really good about sort of highlighting those awkward moments, because I think, you know, as humans, we have more of those than we realize, that like maybe we do that more than we say what's on our mind. So I do love that it always kind of feels like people are going to start talking throughout the entire movie, and then they just never do.
They never get the chance. Yeah, there's a lot of missed connections, which kind of plays, you know, if it was done as a gag, I don't think it would, if it was a gag or a gag level attempt to just do something unique, I think I would have left this film being like, why did you do this? Like, there's no reason here, but there is some thematic stuff happening, as you said, with all these like missed opportunities to communicate that I think do reinforce a lot of the ideas that the film is playing with. And so it worked for me. I didn't have an issue with that, but it is probably not a bad thing to know going in that, you know, this is going to be a movie that is conveyed almost entirely via action and images, right? Like that's what we're getting here. And that's clever, right? It seems like a screenwriting trick. It seems like something a screenwriter who's practicing their craft would do to see if they could do it, right? Can I tell the entire story in big text, right? Instead of in dialogue. And I found it kind of engaging. It was pretty good. So the setup again, she's in this home that she lives in alone. Presumably it was the family home. Her mother apparently has recently passed for, again, reasons unexplained. And she lives there by herself. We get a lovely opening montage about her like sewing dresses and mailing them off via Etsy. So you kind of get an idea of how she's supporting herself while not being able to like engage with the world around her. And then things kind of kick off from there. But I mean, there's really not a ton to say without just giving the whole game away. I know one thing that was a bonus for me, and I assume it was for you based on past experience. This is a 90-minute banger.
Love it.
Like 90 minutes and out. Actually, a little under 90 minutes if you include credits. Like, it's quick. And that's good. I don't think the premise could have survived much more. You maybe could have had a few more action scenes, a few more sort of exploratory, explanatory moments, maybe. But I think this film operates precisely as it should within the 90-minute time frame. It's great.
This is... Well, I don't want to say that because it might spoil it a little bit, but this reminded me of a movie that is better in my memory than the movie actually was. And it's an M. Night Shyamalan movie, and we'll get to which one it is, or should I just say it?
You can say it. It's fine.
It reminds me of Signs. This is like the very version much. Of Signs that exists in my head from when I saw Signs for the first time, and I thought it was like groundbreaking and incredible. But you know, you go back and watch that movie and it's not that great.
It's not.
It has a lot of problems. I think I was just like 14 and I was willing to overlook all of those problems.
Well, Shyamalan is so good at, he's a carnival barker filmmaker. Where he's like, he's got one hand waving. He's like, look over here, look over here, look at all this stuff. And then the other hand that's actually like doing the important things, you just aren't paying attention, right? Yeah. You're just like, oh, well, huh. And the problem with Shyamalan is he's gotten worse at that as time goes on. And the tricks that he's trying to keep you from seeing are just super obvious. He can't hide them anymore. And It's just one of those things. And I'm not a Shyamalan hater. I've liked a lot of his more recent output. You know, we've talked about Old. I think Old was fine. Again, Shyamalan's problem is that he's had to scale back his stories so much to match the budgets he's able to obtain as a filmmaker that he's basically just making Twilight Zone episodes now. Like,
I admire
just all he's doing.
I admire
and
any
fine.
Filmmaker who is willing to put a woman with bonitis in his movie with a straight face. Groundbreaking work.
My only regret is that I had bonitis. it truly is our only regret. It's one of those things. But I think the important takeaway from having a comparison, especially to that phase of Shyamalan's career here, is just how adept Duffield is handling, or how adept Duffield's handling of this film is. Like he is killing it with this.
Yeah.
Like this is a very, very well directed film. And I think he knew it had to be, right? Like you don't write a script like this without realizing how much work the director is going to have to put in to make sure that this story can be told, right? Like, you know, I was watching a movie the other day and it did what so many movies do. Like, and I can't even remember which one, probably because I was rewatching some of the Maze Runner movies. We had watched the first one. I'd never watched the sequels. And like it was like 40 minutes in, and the movie, because it had answered no questions and had set up nothing for the next, you know, act of the film, it just hard stopped, right? Everything hard stopped, and now all the characters are sitting in a room with one new character dumping exposition, right? Just answering questions. Oh, we have to go here. Oh, there's this group that's never been mentioned, but I bet they can help you. They live in the mountains. You should go there. And it's just like, it was so lame and obvious that, you know, again, it's bad screenwriting, and it's the director trying to like, okay, how can we get this information in this film that we need in order to do the rest of the stuff we have to do? And this movie can't have that. There is no opportunity for that. It all has to function. And so, you know, supremely impressed. I also feel like this movie has like incredibly tense moments. It's just, it's very, very smartly designed. It reminded me a little bit of, you know, and this is a weird one to call back to, but, you know, the original Paranormal Activity. Okay. And yeah. I know that, again, Paranormal Activity has like salted the earth of that franchise, rightly so. But the original Paranormal Activity works because it is able to establish an incredible amount of tension with very little happening. Right? Like it doesn't need to be bombastic to make you feel like something is about to happen.
It's just like it's tension building. Yeah.
It's just camera work, positioning, sound effects, all of that stuff kind of coming together, and then you going like, oh, I'm genuinely engaged here. Like I'm concerned about what's about to happen. I recently rewatched the original Blair Witch Project too. And it's very similar. It's a very similar kind of thing. Like most of that movie is a black screen with people screaming over the top of it.
Josh.
And so like during that sequence, when she screams, what is that? What the fuck is that? And then you hear them start running. Dude, like that works. Like that works.
It does.
Gangbusters. 25 years down the line. That is terrifying. And it outlines all of my problems with modern found footage, right? Where like at a certain point, yeah, you're not going to be able to see shit because that person is running as hard as they can. And the camera is like at their side or just, you know, like it's just fucked. And that stuff just works. So again, this movie builds tension. The opening sequences where she's kind of discovering what the threat is and what's happening. You know, she's hiding under the bed at one point, and it's great. Like there's the whole like the thing jumps on top of the bed while she's under it. And man, all that stuff just works gangbusters. Yeah, terrible. And then it just kind of develops in a way that makes a ton of sense and works. So I guess, you know, initially, obviously, I'm pretty glowing on this. If you haven't seen it yet and you have an active Hulu subscription, there's literally no reason not to check it out. It's an absolutely great time. If you don't have a Hulu subscription, I don't know if it's worth signing up for it. It's part of the Disney bundle now. I don't know if you're familiar, but Disney now owns Hulu, and their Hulu's going away, and it's just going to be Disney Plus now. All that stuff's going to be on there, which is a little sad for me. I'm a little sad about that, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Conglomerations, am I right?
I also loved this movie. Obviously, you know, you hit on all the things that excite me about movies. They're short and they're scary. But what I really liked is that this movie does not feel compelled to explain things that don't matter. I loved that so much. It doesn't spend, you know, it doesn't do the exposition scenes, but it just doesn't tell you anything that by the end of it, you don't need to know. And that's great. Like it was just a short, sweet, scary kind of action packed movie. Like I really liked some of the you know, action scenes. This was great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's some good action in this. Given its budget, which this again was about 20 million. Given its budget, there's quite a lot of action and a decent amount of special effects. You know, some flipped cars. There's like a really great scene where a post office truck is kind of flipped on its side, or FedEx or something. You know, just some nice stuff, some good action at the end with some creature characters. It's kind of ticking all the boxes for me, right? Like the types of films that I really enjoy watching 100% works. And this was another one of those where I checked it out. I saw it on Hulu and I was like, oh, that looks interesting. Recognized Duffield's name. I was like, oh, cool. And so I fired it up, watched it all the way through. And then like, I want to say that was early in the day. We got an Apple TV box because our TV is nice, but the built-in apps are already starting to like, you know, eventually they just start running like crap. And it's not terrible, but we were like, you know, let's get, you know, a standalone box, something that we can hook up. And you know,
I always had an Apple TV back when I was a television person. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I had an old one and then an old new one, and they're great. They're great little machines.
The thing that I've really been enjoying about it, especially for, you know, I'm generally the last person up. And so, you know, if there is a movie I want to watch that nobody else is going to be interested in, or I don't know if they're going to be interested in, that's usually when I watch stuff. But, you know, we've got a fairly aggressive home surround sound system, so I can't, you know, and it's no fun watching movies at, you know, 25 volume, right? Like, yeah, at least most of the time. So the new ones, you can just hook your AirPods right up to them. So I just hook my AirPods, AirPod Pros up, and I listen to them through that. And it is remarkably good at emulating surround sound. Like, it's scary how it still feels like I'm listening to stuff in my surround sound system. Like, center channel stuff is center channel stuff. Back channel stuff is back channel stuff. It's really impressive. So I've been doing that. And this was one of those. I watched it like that. And just the sound design in this movie is stellar. Like, it is really good. And just enjoyed it. And then like immediately the next day, because this is a horror film ostensibly, but it's not really. So we watched this as a family. I was like, no, we all need to watch this. I think everybody would enjoy it. And we watched it again and enjoyed it just as much. So definitely a big recommend for me, especially if you're not like, you know, this is not hardcore horror for me. Like, it's very fun. It has horror, you know, scary moments, but that's not really the point, right?
It's funny. I brought up Talk to Me. And the reason I brought up that movie was that I watched this movie and that movie in the same day.
That's cool, because I watched them in very close proximity as well. I don't know if it was the same day, but it was close.
It was the like same day. I had a free evening. I think my partner was working on something and I just sat down. You know, this movie's really short, so it was easy to get out of the way. They're both pretty short. And this was so refreshing because I watched this second. And, you know, I was talking about the brutality and like the struggle I had with watching this poor child get absolutely tortured. And then I watched this like swift, pleasant, almost family appropriate horror movie mm-hmm. where like the worst thing that happens is like they die hard her feet in one part, I always love that because it's like, hey, it's John McClane.
It's a pretty good way to put your main character on their back foot.
I was really hype on this movie because it was exactly what I needed after watching the very, very upsetting scenes in Talk to Me. Because I love horror, but I almost feel like the violence and gore and ultra gruesome stuff is a bit of a crutch sometimes.
Oh, it's absolutely. Like,
instead of building actual tension, instead of doing a what the fuck is that, you know, great scene, most movies will just be like, here's a bunch of blood and some guts and someone being absolutely destroyed physically. And it's like, well, I don't always want that. I wouldn't even say I want that most of the time. So I was really impressed that this didn't indulge in horror in that way.
Yeah, no, it's again, you know, it's so important with a horror film that the horrific elements, the frightening elements serve a larger master in the film, right? Like, that's why I mean, and this is an extreme example, but that's why like stuff like Terrifier doesn't work for me. I've watched the first one. I have the second one, but I'm not sure I'm ever going to watch it because it's just, we know we can do, we can split this lady in half, right? Like that's that kind of stuff. If it's not purposeful, if you're not doing it because it's going to move the story forward or build more tension or raise the stakes so our characters know what's coming next, then it's just gratuitous and it's just there to be gross. And I'm not saying that that's not satisfying in its own way if that's what you're in the mood for.
There's a
right?
time and a
sometimes,
place.
Sure, you know, but those generally are not going to stick with me personally for the long term because I'm not invested in anything that's happening. Right. Yeah. Will I always remember it? Sure. Yeah. I mean,
I'll always remember that time that person got cut in half.
Never going to forget.
But it's also that when something is like excessively gory or excessively gruesome, a lot of the violence kind of loses its impact. And I don't mean like, if violence has to be meaningful, but I think back to movies like Day of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you know which scene I'm going to talk about. It's the one where the Duke is fucking ripped in half.
Yep.
And that scene sticks with, well, that'll be in my head for the rest of my life. Because
along with its imitator in Shaun of the Dead, which is
exactly.
A purposeful recreation. Absolutely. Those two kind of stay in my mind together.
Yeah. That scene is going to stick with me forever because I both wanted to see that because you hate that jackass. And I didn't want to see that because it was horrible and you don't want to see anyone
terrible
be torn in half. And you just want this whole zombie shit to just be over because it's awful. So I feel like when you go into the realm of like, what is it? Is it Eli Roth who does all of the other ones?
Yeah.
When you go into like that realm of horror, which like Hostel I enjoyed. I actually enjoyed
that movie. The first one's not bad. But again, it has a story. Like you're somewhat invested in who those characters are.
And the violence has some sort of purpose behind it. Otherwise, I don't know. It just feels like, why am I watching this? I don't know why I'm here.
Yeah. And again, it depends what you're looking for in a horror film experience. And I've got lots of people I know that, you know, for them, you know, watching horror is about seeing somebody get killed in an interesting way and then seeing some sweet, sweet boobage, right? Like, and you know, if that's what you're going for, you're going to find it and great. You know, I mean, somebody needs to watch, you know, Slumber Party Massacre 5, like somebody needs to be into that. And that's great,
but it's not
again,
me.
That's not me. And again, that's what it comes down to. That's not what I find engaging in the horror space. Right. That's not the kind of film that I generally engage with again and again and again. You know, you might watch it once and be like, oh, that's funny, but it's never going to be Evil Dead 2. Right. Yeah. Like it's never going to be
The Exorcist.
That. Yeah. It's never going to. Oh, my God. I rewatched The Exorcist not too long ago and it had been forever. You know, like Exorcist is one of those movies that has been parodied and stolen from and copied from for so long that I never felt like I needed to come back to it. And then I got a Wild Hair not too long ago and kind of had it on and dude, that movie is incredible. It's so good.
I had a wonderful moment. My partner revealed that he was like, I don't think I've seen it. And he's like, I know the movie. Cause you just know it.
You just know it. Yeah.
He's like, but I don't think I've ever like watched the film. And I'm like, what are you saying? And he's like, would you like to watch The Exorcist? Do you have that movie? And I'm like, oh honey, yes I do.
Of course.
And yes, I would. Let's watch it right now. And it was fantastic. And of course, like I'm such an insufferable jackass to watch movies with. Cause I'm like pausing and saying like, now look at this part coming up. I hate myself.
But you know, Exorcist is now foundational to the fabric of horror films that we know today. And, you know, and we still see that divide, right? The A24 Ari Aster elevated horror films. And then, you know, your slasher garbage, whatever. And I don't love those distinctions because they all have their place. Right. And I think that there's, you know, Stephen Graham Jones just, you know, it didn't just, but he just wrapped up the trilogy of his slasher homage books that started with My Heart is a Chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's somebody who's taking slashers and then turning it into, like, you can always do that, man. You can take these things that most people see as garbage and you can turn it into something that is brilliant and masterful. And that's really what gets me excited, is when somebody takes something that is generally devalued by most people and gives it value. And so I don't want to make it seem like I have no love for the slasher genre, because I do. You know, I love Halloween like everybody else. I thought the last Halloween movie was okay.
I liked
Halloween Ends or whatever the fuck it was called. I thought it was good. I liked that it wasn't all about Michael Myers and it was about evil and all this other esoteric bullshit. Like, it was fun. It was like, yeah, this is good. Sure, whatever, do it. The horror movies with ideas, I love it. Horror movies with ideas that still burn people's heads out with flares from the inside. Yeah. No, it's just one of those things where that's not the stuff that gets me excited about the horror space. Right. And that is okay, because not everything has to be for me. I am a white man in my 40s, which means that everything is apparently supposed to be for me. And if it's not, I get to be angry about it online, specifically on X / Twitter. I can go
on
there and
just be mad. I don't know what that is.
I could just be mad about it. This isn't made for me. It's got women in it. I'm mad about everything. I could go do that, but I generally don't. And that's probably for the best. So yes, another recommend here. So let's get into spoilers. If you have not seen this yet and you don't want it spoiled for you, definitely go check it out before you finish. It is worth it. It's fun and it's better if you don't know what's coming. So spoilers. This is a movie about aliens.
Fuck yeah.
Which I should have realized. I didn't really look at the art very closely when I clicked on it, because the art makes it pretty clear what's happening. There's some common iconography of the alien abduction genre that's at play.
I kind of thought that would be a fake out. I thought, like, sure, this is like some joke about alien abduction, and it'll be, right, you know, instead like a space death cult or something, you know, something stupid.
Yeah, I didn't think that it was going to go so hard so fast. But it's another thing I tremendously respect, is that it doesn't beat around the bush and it doesn't try to be anything it's not. I really thought that Duffield was going to try and keep the game going for a while where we didn't know what this was. Right. But it doesn't.
Like, nope, like, it's aliens.
It's aliens, fucker. And it's not just any kind of alien. It's the aliens that, you know, it's the little gray guys with the big black
X-Files
eyes.
Aliens.
Like, yeah, it's X-Files. Like, we're not even going to pretend that it's not. Like, you just see one right now.
Or, like, what was that? What was that movie, the made-for-TV Fox movie with D.B. Sweeney that was all about aliens? And he got abducted.
Oh, Fire in the Sky.
Fire in the Sky. Scared the shit out of me.
Oh, Fire in the Sky is terrifying.
I was way too young to be watching that shit.
Yeah, yeah. Fire in the Sky is legitimately frightening.
But, like, we need more alien stuff. Like, genuine, just alien autopsy, X-Files, 90s era Fox television aliens. That's what I
totally
want.
I think X-Files kind of killed it, because it was such a huge part of that series. And it kind of just went out with a wet fart at the end.
We flew too close to the sun.
We got too close and it just kind of all died. And we can blame Chris Carter and his fucking surfboard. But I agree. I think it comes in waves. You know, there is a lot of cultural sort of UFO chatter right now. Like, all, you know, all these people that are saying the government's about to declassify a bunch of UFO documents and we'll finally know. And it's like, yeah, no, like, no, maybe. I don't know. I mean, sure, why not? Yeah, weather balloons. It's all weather balloons. I don't know. But it does seem like culturally we're kind of back in a spot where alien stuff is kind of exciting again. Like, I think we got oversaturated, you know, X-Files and post X-Files. And we're kind of swinging back around to it. And this is certainly a good example of where we could go. Because I think one of the most important things about alien-related stuff is that it just has to feel grounded. It has to feel real. It has to feel legitimate. And I think this movie does a good job of that. Like, nothing in here is so fanciful and out of this world. Sorry. didn't mean to make a pun there, but it's nothing is it all. Everything in this film kind of lines up with the stuff that we believe we know about aliens, right? The flying saucers, the little gray guys, all of that stuff just is there. And that common sort of shared language and set of visual symbols is just present that we can access. And it's not trying to do something different. It's not, oh, they're gray aliens, but they have a third arm on their ass, right? Or something like that. Like, it's
they
not
poop
trying
to see.
Right. Like, it's just, no, we're not doing that. This, it does play with, there are different versions of the gray aliens, you know, like that apparently have different purposes kind of thing. But it's just, it's all handled very, very well. And I think that that works, but I'm kind of in the same boat. I think I'm ready for some more, you know, if it's not alien abduction, you know, just, you know, something kind of bringing the extraterrestrial back into common fiction. And it just doesn't feel like we've been there for a bit. I'm sure there's always been an undercurrent. Like, these things never go away. Like, even when everybody says that slashers were dead in the 90s and Scream brought them back, it's like, they kind of weren't. I mean, they were all still being made. They just weren't as popular. They weren't that cultural moment that they had been in the 80s. So, I guess let's get into the story. It's pretty brief. I don't think it'll take us long to go through it. Which again, bonus. That's benefit. Yay. But so we open on, what's her name? Bryn. Is that her name?
Yeah.
I think it's Bryn. So we open on Bryn, which we know because of some of the things. Again, this is a silent film for all intents and purposes. So we learn all of this by seeing her sort of morning routine. She wakes up, she, you know, gets ready. She puts on a lovely summer dress. She's making dresses, and then she is mailing, shipping something to an Etsy customer. And so she says, like, thank you, Bryn. So that's how we know what her name is. And then everything gets weird. She leaves the house. She's in her car. Is it like a poppy music montage? I don't remember what was playing, but, you know, there's like a, it's very upbeat. Like, you feel like, oh, okay, this girl's kind of got it together. She's got a cool little life here.
Yeah. And it's very cute. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's trying to tug on my interests a little bit, because, like, she has the cute summer sundresses and she lives in this big, like, fucking dollhouse, and she has, like, all of these neat little things, and, like, it's a very twee, very sweet life. And then as soon as she leaves the house, everyone hates her.
Yeah, like, everyone, she sees a guy that she obviously thinks, I was going to ask you this, do you think she's attracted to that guy? That's kind of the impression that I got, that she's, you know, potentially interested, and he just completely blows her off, says nothing to her,
turns around and walks away,
just like, walks away,
and she's like waving happily at him, and he's just like, fuck you,
right? And we don't know this, and I love the fact that this film wastes no time in telling us it's fucking aliens, but the thing that it does prolong is, why does everybody hate Bryn, right? Yeah. That's the thing that we don't learn, and I think that that's such an intelligent choice. Right? Because we expect a film to not tell us it's aliens for as long as possible. That's classic genre movie 101.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is the opposite of what this film does. And it's very refreshing. But yeah, she has all these like stunted interactions. She seems legitimately concerned to be seen in town. You know, she just has to mail this package, right? She's got to, you know, get this thing out the door for her business, but she's covering her face. She's wearing these big sunglasses.
And then she goes to a cemetery and has like a little mini picnic by her mother's grave.
Right.
And that's when I started to realize, like, okay, something bad happened.
Real like, bad.
She's not just unpopular in town. She is like maybe not. I don't know. It felt really obvious to me from the cemetery scene forward that like she has done something.
Mm-hmm.
And now yes. I really want to know what it is.
Right. This is really, really effective visual storytelling. You know, because we wouldn't necessarily even know that this woman is her mother unless we had seen her write her name as Bryn. And then the headstone specifically says loving mother to Bryn. Right. Like, it, you know, as a person who enjoys storytelling and the process of visual storytelling, like it's incredibly difficult to plan for all of those pieces to be in place. Right. And it just speaks to me again of an accomplished filmmaker that he's well aware of what needs to be established for the story to get told in this manner. Cause again, nobody's talking. But then, you know, this day out excursion that she's on ends with her literally hiding behind her car as two people unidentified. One is a police officer. The other is just sort of an older woman. As they kind of are walking and talking to each other, and Bryn seems mortified that she's almost run into them. Then we get our first Dear Maud letter. And here's where, again, you know, this is a film that has no dialogue, so this is how you can work in some of those things. But she starts writing a letter, and then we find out, oh, these were the parents of a girl named Maud. And again, if you're a careful viewer and you're invested in what's going on already, you can probably start putting the pieces together of what has happened. But it's not obvious, and it's just sort of backgrounded to make sure that, you know, the threads are being sort of set in place. But the film is not wasting a ton of time being like, you really need to focus on this right now. It's just kind of putting these things in place so that you, when everything does become clear, you know, right? It's enough that you understand what's happening. Like talking about Scream earlier, right? Like there's no threads in Scream to help you understand what's happening, right? Like none. But this film is very concerned about making sure that when the reveals come, you know what's happening. So very cool. But we get our first Dear Maud letter. We find out that they're Maud's parents. And so we can start to kind of piece together what's happening. Then again, we just kind of go back to Bryn's twee life, right?
Yeah.
She's bought a dance instruction set. Well, no, that's not what she bought. She bought the schoolhouse, right? Because she also has
stickers on her floor to teach her how to dance.
To teach her how to dance, right? Which is a plot point for later.
She cooks herself a meal that looks like, I don't know, it's like an Instagram influencer kind of life where it's like,
absolutely.
Wow, so cute. Wish that I looked like that and had that house, and that would be great. And
yeah,
I especially love when she's making her dinner and the phone rings and she just walks over to it and hangs it up.
Just bloop. And you hear like a brief thing on there, but somebody just like immediately starting to scream. and she just like picks it up and laps it off and not even going to pay attention.
Like it becomes really unsettling because you start to wonder like if she's crazy or like how bad is it? I don't know. I think this was really teased out really well.
It's teased out exceptionally well. And it does exactly what you're, you know, classic screenwriting 101. First 10 minutes of your movie, you need to establish what's happening and get your audience invested in the major plot points. And so like at this point, we are almost exactly like, I think we're only like 8 minutes in at this point. So this movie has done a tremendous amount of heavy lifting at telling us who this girl is, what's going on in her life. Things are bad. What happened? This Maud girl's probably involved because they were best friends, but she's writing her a letter. So you're like, well, maybe Maud just lives somewhere else now. Maybe Maud doesn't want to see her anymore either. Like there's enough that you're invested, but not so much that all of the pieces have fallen into place yet. Again, you can make guesses and you could probably be very close, but you're not going to know exactly at this point. And that's great. That's exactly what you want out of a story as it's getting going. And then again, following that classic 10 minutes and out, what happens at 10 minute mark? The aliens show up. Like, and it wastes no time. It's great. Like, the lights start flickering and freaking out. She did see when she left, and I really liked this small detail too. She did see when she left her house in the morning that there was kind of like a ring of dead grass, which, you know, is, again, if you live in the country, it's not uncommon to see things like that from, you know, maybe there was a leak in a sewage system or something like that. Like, you can see things like that, but she sees it, notices it because she, again, lives in this like perfect house in the middle of nowhere. But now we find out that, you know, it's kind of all related. It's like a marking scheme where things are being identified. But so her lights start freaking out, which I really loved all of that. And then, you know, she's awakened by some loud sounds and our first alien visit begins. And again, you know, I know we were talking earlier about, you know, tension and sort of this film does a great job of building tension in scenes. This scene is a masterclass of how to shoot a horror scene.
Yeah.
Right. Like subtle sounds, you know, the character is sort of in a position to observe, but not be observed. Like it's very, very well done. And again, wastes no time in showing us that this is not a human, even though you might initially think it is. This is not a human, and Bryn has a reason to be scared. You know, the cool thing is that the scene culminates, and one of the things that I also like that gets established about Bryn very quickly is that she's extremely resourceful, right? Like she's not just going to lay down and die. She's not going to freak out. She's got some plans within plans of how she might be able to get out of this. And I really liked that component of it as well, that she's not just going to be afraid. She is going to try and fight back in some way. Worth noting that the special effects on these creatures are great. I thought the creatures looked really good. A couple of shots, maybe the compositing work could have been a bit stronger, but you know, for a film that cost, I don't know, the price of two American cheeseburgers, I think it looks pretty phenomenal, right? For a $20 million picture, the special effects and visual effects in this are really, really good.
I had it out on the internet the other day. I don't know. I read something about Ang Lee's Hulk. And it had to do with the CG looking bad. And I I have just arrived at the conclusion that I don't care. I just don't care.
Sure.
I want it to be good enough that it's not like offensively bad. Like that's like, it's not going to distract from the rest of the film. But if a few shots look cheesy or if they look cheap, oh, well, is the rest of the movie good? And the rest of this movie is so good. Who cares? I don't care. I can't.
Right.
I can't bring myself to care.
I think it's time for us to, I'm not going to say move away from, you know, being angry at movies for the quality of their special effects. You know, we're in the midst of the Marvel films being sort of constantly accused that they look terrible because they're just nothing but special effects. And I think that that is a point of valid criticism, more so because it speaks to a larger problem in the film industry where these people need to be paid better and given more time to do what they need to do. Like that's really where the criticism should be levied, not on the end product of the special effects and visual effects themselves. I think it's more, this industry is ruining people to get these things done. And we just really need to step back and look at what's the role of visual effects in modern filmmaking? You know, how can we do this in a way that's equitable? How can we produce these things in a way that's humane and treats people with respect and gives them credit for the things that they do? Like there's a lot of questions that go into this, but I don't think we should still be in the spot where we go to engage with a film, right? A piece of art that's trying to tell a story. And then, you know, our critique or review of it is bagging on the visual effects for 20 minutes, you know, And unfortunately, it seems like we're a lot of people are still very much in that space. And I get it. It's, you know, I watched Blade 2 not too long ago, which, you know, we've talked about, and I don't love Blade 2, even though it is a Del Toro film, and I ostensibly love most of his movies. But that was an early example of digital doubling post-Matrix, which, of course, The Matrix was one of the first films to have, like, full digital body doubles, and didn't work out that great. And by the time we get to Blade, which was, like, 2 years later, it still wasn't working out that great. And we're still not there, right? Still not, just doesn't work that great. And, you know, I'm just kind of tired of being mad about it. I don't think it matters. Now, if it's something that takes you completely out of the film, like if the special effects work or visual effects work in most cases is so bad that you can't engage with the film as it's being presented, then I get it. Sure. I understand.
Most of the time in those cases, it's because the film doesn't have anything else going on.
Exactly. Like your problem is actually with other more important things. It's just what you're seeing, the things going into your eyeballs at that moment are the bad visual effects.
Yeah.
But are you really, if the visual effects are so-so, but the film and the story and the characters are hyper engaging, you're probably not going to care. You know?
I go back to like the entire superhero movie trend of the early 2000s, where the effects were all bad.
All bad.
But the movies were so good.
Yeah, they're fun.
You know, and they stand the test of time because I think they knew they had to make a really good movie with a good engaging plot because the effects were going to be bad.
Right. What else do we have?
Yeah. You
know, and it's also, I think a lot of people would say that one of the more successful superhero projects of the last couple of years was the second Doctor Strange movie. And you know, who directed that but Sam Raimi, who understands that, you know, visual effects are only going to get you so far. Yeah. He learned that lesson with Oz the Great and Powerful.
Yeah.
And I think he came down on the other side being like, maybe we should do more in-camera stuff, you guys. Maybe we should. But again, that was even that was not fully Sam Raimi's fault because they wanted another Alice in Wonderland. That's what they wanted. And they wanted it with Wizard of Oz because that was a property they also own. And so, you know, Disney got exactly what they asked for. But this film...
And somewhere... A finger on a withered monkey paw curls inward.
Oh, Bob Iger, what have you done? What sacrifices have you made? But so with this one, regardless, our first alien encounter is extensive. It's a like 10 or 12 minute action sequence that culminates in Bryn confronting one of these aliens that has obviously been sent to capture her. We don't really know what the aliens goal is yet, which I think is also very cool. Like all that
toes.
Is not get laid out. He does have weirdo feet. He's got little finger feet.
It reminded me of some of my Spore creations.
Totally. Yeah. Absolutely what you would find in one of those early Spore character creators, that kind of thing. But Bryn actually escapes the alien, is in the process of running away, gets. It's being good special effects, not visual effects, gets nailed in the face by a door. Like, just takes a hard hit to the face and winds up using one of her little, like, because she has a little Beetlejuice town replication in her. And that's what I thought of immediately.
We love
like,
a Beetlejuice callback.
She's got a little Beetlejuice town.
Like that. And, that's, you know, the hobby of shut-ins, I guess. You build replicas of the life that you can't engage with.
Exactly. I can't engage with this town anymore, so I'm just going to build a little town that I can engage with. But she uses a piece of it to kill the alien. She stabs it in the head and kills it, prolonging her you know, conversion or whatever it is they want to do. You know, this sets up, she goes out the next day and decides, you know, she's going to escape. She wants to get out of town. And, you know, that sort of sets up the rest of the film where she is just sort of narrowly avoiding being captured by these aliens, who have been sort of slowly and methodically, presumably over the last several days, converting people with some kind of parasite, I think is kind of what we see later. They put something inside of them, and then that makes them docile and willing to accept orders or whatever. So it's a slow, quiet invasion of the planet, which again, I think is very classic sci-fi. You know, it's very Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's very, you know, sort of that 50s B sci-fi film where, you know, they were all just very, very thinly veiled references to communism, you know, invading the American dream and killing us all from the inside. But you know, this first encounter ends with Bryn sort of, we get a nice hard cut to the morning where she's just been staring at this dead thing on her floor for the entire night. Again, I think it's worth mentioning that Caitlin Devers is phenomenal in the lead of this. Like, yeah. She has one line, one in this entire film, yet she commands this film using all of her other skills as an actor, right? Her facial expressions, her minor vocalizations, right? I mean, she does emote, she does express, but you know, she doesn't get the benefit of being able to deliver dialogue on screen, which is like what most actors do. So, she's great. Like, she is, I'll admit I was not aware of a ton of her work prior to this. But she's definitely on my radar now. I will be very interested to see what she does next. And I hope she gets to work with Duffield. They obviously are a good pairing here. Like,
yeah.
I can imagine so much of this film was really Duffield and Devers sort of hashing out, like, how do we express this? How do we show this? How can you bring this to life given that you can't say anything? And it just works gangbusters. Like, she's so, so good in this film. She carries the whole film. Like, you hear movies about, there was a recent Actors on Actors. I guess now that the strike's over, Vanity Fair and all those places can start publishing all their shit that they've recorded with actors that they've had to hold for months. And it was Cillian Murphy and Margot Robbie talking about the Barbenheimer phenomenon. And she asked him, because, you know, Oppenheimer is really Cillian Murphy's first leading role with Christopher Nolan. He's always played supporting bits in the Nolan films of varying sizes. You know, obviously he's a big part of Inception and other films. But, you know, so Robbie asked him, was it different to be like the guy, right? Like, it's you're the film. And you know, Murphy sort of went into detail and said, yeah, it was very different to feel like you have to carry you're carrying the film on your shoulders, right? Like, it's all about sort of what you're bringing to the table, and you have to be ready. And, you know, it's kind of crazy to think about that. You know, she's in every scene of this film, like every shot of this film, Caitlin Devers is in it somewhere. And that's tremendous. That's a lot of effort on the part of an actor to be that involved.
Only thing that I had seen her in before this, I think, wasn't she in like Dear Evan Hansen?
Yes. She played the sister. Yeah, that was terrible.
But she was great. She was great. God. It was mostly just Ben Platt that was off-putting.
Yeah, he should have stepped aside and given that to another more age-appropriate actor. I don't hate Ben Platt.
He did another movie on Hulu. Voice like an angel.
He did another movie on Hulu. Was it Theater Camp? And it's awesome. Like, brilliant. I loved it. It's like a faux documentary about all of these losers who work at a theater camp in the summer. It's great. And he's awesome.
And I also saw her, she was in that Olivia Wilde movie, Booksmart.
Booksmart, yes. That's where I knew her from, yes.
And I actually enjoyed that movie. I'm not a huge fan of Olivia Wilde generally.
Yeah.
But
Don't Worry, Darling was a travesty. Should be scrubbed from the annals of the internet. It's such a stupid idea. But anyway.
But the thing about Booksmart was that it was carried by Caitlin Dever and Beanie Feldstein. Mm-hmm. Just being like these really engaging, really charming actresses. And I liked their dynamic so much. And I liked her so much in that movie. I was really happy to see her in something again. And certainly glad that she wasn't like part of a duo. This is just her being the star. And it's really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Because especially, you know, movies like Booksmart, where, you know, they were, it is disingenuous to say it's Super Bad But Girls, but that's how it was marketed, was Super yeah. Bad But Girls.
Yeah.
I think it's a much better film than Super Bad at the end of the day. It's easy to, you know, because look at what happened to Michael Cera and Jonah Hill post that movie.
Do I have to?
Not necessarily, but they became the duo guys, right? Like, oh, we're going to put these people with other people and then they're going to, you know, be funny. And so, yes, it's really nice that she's getting the chance to just do her thing here. Duffield also does a great job, like, because she basically gets Ripley'd in this movie. Like, she becomes like Ellen Ripley, right? Where she's just like an unstoppable force, where she just will not give up in the face of overwhelming adversity. And it's great. Like, it's so engaging. You know, we were watching it with, you know, as a family, and my daughter's watching. She was just like totally into it. She's like, yeah, get him. You know, go, you go, girl. But one of the things that is great about Ripley's characterization, even in the original Alien, but definitely in Aliens, is that she's not perfect, right? She's not Schwarzenegger. She's got, you know, like when her and Newt get trapped, you know, in the med bay and they're trying to escape the facehugger, you know, like she's scared and she's not standing up and she's like, come, fight me, you know, like she's not doing anything like that. And so there's always this, like, she's still a person, right? And that's what makes those movies work so gangbusters. And so, like, this film does the same thing. She's just killed an extraterrestrial in her home, right? And she's done something incredible. And so she goes out to get in her car. And she gets in her car and, of course, she's wearing like her nightdress and all this stuff. And like her nightdress is like hanging out the bottom of the door. she doesn't get it all in there. And I don't know, little moments like that, you know, sort of do a lot to me to sort of keep characters human, even though you're putting them on this track to ostensibly do something that most humans probably wouldn't be able to do, you know.
Oh, I would be the first one murdered or converted by the aliens. I know that.
I swear I have seen like 4 memes. I don't know if it's like a post-apocalypses are back again in meme culture, but I've seen like 4 memes over the last couple of weeks where it's like, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland survivor and it's some badass dude with a gun. And then the follow-up is just a person with a gun in their mouth. it's like post-apocalyptic survivor me. It's true. Most people in those circumstances are not going to be able to survive in the way that we feel like we would, you know? And I'm not saying that as a person who believes in suicide.
No, I'm saying like that would be better than starving to death, which is what I would also do because I'm too stupid to find my own food.
it's this very interesting attitude. So her car won't start. I guess we'll get back on track. Her car won't start. So she goes back in the house, takes a shower, gets cleaned up. I love the meticulousness with which she's trying to cover up like her injuries. Because she thinks that people might notice or care. And then I the last thing I really like is that she takes the moment to like block her front door with a couch. Like somebody's gonna, like it's gonna deter somebody from breaking into her home. But so she goes into town, she has the idea to just get on a bus and just leave. She tries to go to the police station to tell people what's happening and then gets spit on by this woman that we've seen earlier identified as Maude's parents. So we kind of get a little bit more detail. Apparently whatever happened was pretty bad.
And it was her fault.
And she did it, right? Like it wasn't her mom. It wasn't any, it was her, it's her fault. And then we get that great shot of her on the wall where she's crying. And then it's like the red haired girl. So I think we're obviously supposed to think that this is a, because we've seen a picture of Maude and she was a redhead. So I think we're supposed to know that this is maybe some kind of tribute to her, perhaps. I mean, again, nothing explicit expressed, but I think that's the implication being made. And anyway, it's a nice set of scenes. Sort of, we get a little bit of that larger exposition in the midst of her trying to figure out how she's going to handle this. And then that's where she gets the idea to just get on a bus and get out of town. But that can't happen because weirdo FedEx guy that was fucking with all of her packages shows up, and now he has been taken, infected, something. But he attacks her and attempts to prevent her from leaving. Weirdo thing in his neck or something, you know, like we get some nice, you know, little subtle visual effects on that. But yeah, so there's a full on invasion happening here. This isn't just her. This is happening, you know, all over. And so then things accelerate. And again, we don't have to hit every moment, but she gets back home finally, and realizes that the alien is, something crawled out of it and into the yard. And, so now we're sort of fully enmeshed in this parasite idea. And then we get one of my favorite things in all of movies, the preparation montage, the home alone,
yep, the home alone scene,
the home aloneing of her house where she is preparing. She knows they're coming back. She knows this isn't over. And I don't think there's a universe in which these scenes are not great. Like, just watching a human being apply their own ingenuity and their own knowledge of their home and their space to surviving some kind of onslaught, be it from the soggy bandits or
I love fortifications, so and I love Rube Goldberg machines that will thwart invaders. I don't know. There's something thrilling about it. It makes me want to build my own little fort in my house. Even though nothing is coming for me. We've already talked about what would happen to me if something did.
I don't know. If it came down to fortification skills, I think you've got that covered. You can handle that.
Yeah.
So again, I like the pacing and the measured sort of way in which these scenes play out. Her house that night is invaded by two aliens, another sort of gray alien of the type that she killed, who seems more curious about her than anything else. Like it's really trying to sort of, it steals a picture of her and Maude. It's, you know, sort of tracking her through the house. And then go ahead.
I kind of got the feeling that the aliens were like, wow, she killed one of us. How did she do that? I didn't know they could do that. And like, they're sending aliens to like check her out. Like, who is she? Find out more.
Yeah, it definitely does seem like there's, you know, obviously there's intelligence here. And in this case, they are interested in sort of knowing who this person is. But we also get introduced to our first sort of alien variant, where it's still obviously from the same stock, if you want to call it that. But this one is much shorter. It has longer arms and legs. And this is the one that she gets to employ her fortifications against. She's like throwing buckets of hot water on it. She gets into a physical fight with it and just bites it, just straight up bites it on the arm, which I thought was awesome. I forget, there was I watched a little bit of behind the scenes stuff on this, and apparently they had like a picture of this one that they would show up just so that everybody kind of knew what it was supposed to look like. They didn't have like a full mock-up of it or anything. And apparently it was just referred to as little fucker. Like, so it was like, oh, she's in a fight with little fucker. And it kind of goes from there. But we also, again, this scene very smartly, you know, we've talked about Nolan this episode already, but one of the things Nolan is known for is his way of sort of cagely incorporating exposition into scenes, right? Like, you know, he has the traditional exposition scenes, but more often than not, Nolan will just incorporate exposition into existing action, right? Which is how it's generally supposed to be done. And so throughout this scene, we're actually learning more about the aliens' technology, right? So the aliens are, telekinetic, right? They can move things with their minds, which we did see a little bit of in the first encounter, but we see that they're even more controlled about it, that they can, you know, lift things and hold things and, do all kinds of mental telekinetic gymnastics. At least the grays, like the full size ones. The little one just seems to be more of an enforcer, just, you know, sort of physical violence. But we also do get our first shot, of the, like, possession beam. I don't even know what to call it. It's like the thing, I guess what you would think of as the traditional sort of like being lifted up to the mothership
tractor
beam, the tractor beam. Yeah. I guess that's really what it is. The tractor beam. So she's fighting with these aliens. It's a great scene. It's very engaging. It's very fun. And she just, again, she's getting Ripley'd really hard here, where she's just like not giving up. She's fighting tooth and nail. She's going after it with mops and she kills one of them again, right? She kills the little fucker. She stabs him with the mop handle and kills him. And I don't know, man, all these scenes worked for me. They're great. I love it. Just all this stuff is so fun.
The only thing that was breaking my heart was seeing her house get so fucked up.
Oh, destroyed.
Because yeah. You love her house. It is a dollhouse. And then, oh, the aliens are wrecking it.
They're wrecking everything. So she does escape to the out of doors again, sort of leaps down from a window. And then we're introduced to another variant. And this one is like a daddy long legs. again, the sound design is great. They all make these different sounds. There's some kind of like guttural barks that they yell at each other. But I love the debut of the daddy long legs, because she's got this, again, it's a storybook house. It's a dollhouse. She's got this beautiful shed in the backyard and she's hearing these noises. And you just see this little head pop up over the top of it. And then immediately it's these giant, like, weirdo spider legs.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's crazy. But they're obviously using some kind of semaphore, I guess. Like, they have these positions they put themselves in that seem to be, like, signaling to each other.
Yeah.
Again, very cool. Like, I don't know, man. Like, it's world building doesn't have to be over-explained. But even putting something like that into a film like this just implies organization and structure. You know, it does a lot of the heavy lifting for implying that this, you know, this is like an organized group that she's fighting against. And then probably I would say the best sort of stunt / visual effect in the film is she's being dragged by the FedEx guy to the ship that's revealed, right? Which is traditional flying saucer. And the tractor beam comes down and she works her way out of it just enough that it like breaks this dude in half. Like, he just gets vivisected basically. And it's awesome. The alien does its semaphore thing to like summon the beam, I guess. And then she escapes yet again. And again, great. I mean, this is all like really good action. She kills one of them by trapping it in her car and then lighting the gas tank on fire and killing it. Awesome. Like, it's just great. So good. And then we get, I guess you could call it an exposition dump. I think it's more skillful than that, but we finally go inside Bryn's room, which is a bit of a reveal, I guess, because she doesn't sleep in her room. In this house, she's obviously been sleeping in her mother's room. And so now visually we get kind of told the story of Bryn and her friend Maud, and we find out that all the letters that she's been writing, this is where they go. They wind up here because Maud very obviously is no longer alive. The thing that makes the scene work is that we're seeing through the alien's eyes.
Yeah. Like, right? They are the learning alien. About her.
Right. The alien is the one figuring out who this girl is.
Why do you keep killing us?
Why are you killing us?
How
why
are you so powerful?
Why are you fighting us? Right. It's like that classic question. Like, well, how are you doing this? And why are you doing this? Like, what are you fighting for? Right. It almost seems to be the implied question that the aliens are trying to answer. And the answer is nothing. Like, she doesn't have anything, but yet she still has this drive to persist. And so, you know, the alien is exploring it. It hurls her through a wall, which, man, what a great stunt. Like, that was an awesome stunt. It's not every day you get to see somebody get hurled through a wall and have it look quite that good. And then she is finally infected, right? So the alien sort of lifts her up to the ceiling and then infects her with a parasite from its own body. And Bryn wakes up, everything is, you know, quote unquote, back to normal. And more importantly, Maud is still alive. So the aliens, through this investigation, have, I guess, given her this hallucination to try and placate her in some way. And the filmmaking here is very good. Maud's always in sort of soft focus. You can't really see her face. You know who it is, but you know, the actor portraying them doesn't really get to take the scene away from Caitlin Dever. It's still very much about her. But she rejects this, of course, right? She's not going to accept that this is true. She knows it's not true. And I guess that's when we get the, it's not yet, but we get the final reveal. She does eventually get taken up into the mothership, which again is a very cool scene, very traditional alien abduction kind of scene. It's lit really well. A lot of like great dusky lighting through trees kind of stuff. Really cool. So she gets taken up to the mothership, and then finally one of these aliens touches her mind and, you know, has to know, like, what is going on with you? Like, why are you so fucked up? Like, what is happening? And then we finally see the trauma, right? The thing that has isolated Bryn from everyone in the town in which she lives, and has left her friendless and alone. She got into a fight with Maud over, we don't know, right? We have no context for that, but Maud pushed her down.
It doesn't matter because they're children.
It doesn't matter. Exactly. Like
what would a child ever argue about that would matter that much?
Exactly. Right. Are they, you know, fighting over, you know, a lost item? Are they fighting over a person? Makes no difference. But the thing that does matter is that in her rage, Bryn picked up a rock and killed Maud with that rock, hit her in the head with it.
And it's great because you know that she didn't mean to do that. But, like, it is also a really brutal, really rage-filled moment that you see from her where it's like, wow, you didn't know your own power and you didn't know that you were capable of that. This was effective. I thought this was sad and, like, appropriately sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's plausible that two children engaged in a rage-filled fight would make a choice and do this, not fully comprehending in the moment what the stakes were.
Exactly.
And then to have her life be sort of in essence ruined by it, and rightly so. Like, I mean, she killed someone, you know, like there's no excuse for it. There's no like, oh, well, you know, she didn't mean it.
Exactly.
You know, perhaps internally she feels it, but the consequences make sense. And so that sets up the final sequence of the film where Bryn is not kept inside of the ship, and we return to another sort of very similar morning montage. She rides her bike in because we've already been shown that like cars and stuff don't really work when the aliens are around. You know, there's like some, I guess, EMP or something. So she rides her bike into town. She's building, I guess she also builds bird houses. Is that a thing she does too? I know there was one at her mother's grave as well. But so we see everybody sort of working in harmony, right? Like the guy that she had a terrible interaction with before is now smiling and laughing, but we also see very clearly he's got one of the things in his neck. Mm-hmm. And so like, I don't know about you, but I initially thought like, oh, like, is this how the invasion works? And is Bryn now just part of this happy invasion group, but she gets what she wants? And I guess we don't know for sure, but I think, so the ending is a dance, right? She goes into town, everybody's there. The guy that blew her off earlier, but now seemingly, you know, is nice to her. They're dancing and it's beautiful and it's rose gold. It becomes
like a little dollhouse fantasy.
It's a fantasy. And so like, I've seen a lot of people online being like, oh, is she just one of them now? And I think the answer is no.
No, I took this as the aliens interface with her. They see what she did and how she exists, the life that she leads. And of course, we have that scene where, you know, the alien is in her bedroom poring over all of the letters. And I assumed that, like, they all come to the consensus that, like, hey, she's going to torture herself way worse than we ever could.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll let her have this little delusion. Yeah, yeah, like she won't stop. She's not going to give up, because if she was going to do that, she would have done it a long time ago before we ever got involved. So it's like they just let her have this delusion.
Yeah.
And that's like, it.
I mean, their goal apparently from the start was to just infect people with parasites and slowly take over the planet. You know, what their goals are after that, if they're going to like mine us for resources, Independence Day style,
alien
or whatever,
shit, you know, whatever aliens love to do.
It doesn't matter. But the point is that this girl, you know, was capable of resisting all of their methods to control people, including rejecting the parasite. And so they were their solution presumably was, well, just give her what she wants.
Go
let
off,
her
sis.
Engage with this community, you know,
enjoy.
Let her have this. And if we give her that, she'll be fine. We don't have to worry about it anymore.
I don't think she's going to get in our way.
and you know, I kind of love it. I think that's brilliant.
It was great. Right? It was very bleak. I mean, even, and I love it because, you know, this sweet little moment is playing out with like all the people dancing in the town square. And it's like, oh God, that's awful.
Right. Like it's
sad.
It's not true, but
yeah.
I think the interesting idea here is that Bryn, the truth of Bryn's life was devastating and isolating, and she was more than willing to let go of that truth if it was slightly more real, you know, I guess. I don't know, it's hard to say, but I just like that the aliens in some ways capitulated, right? Like she proved herself such a formidable adversary that they were just like, yeah, just give it to, like, just let her have it. Like, just go ahead. It reminded me a little bit of the ending of Bird After Reading. Right. Where it's like, it gets to the end and J.K. Simmons is looking at the case. He's like, just give her the boobs. Just let her have them. I don't care. Just write the check. Like, I want this to go away. I don't want to think about this anymore. Just give it to her. It was the same kind of idea of like, just some member of upper management, you know, the giant eye in the sky inside the ship was like, fine, I don't, whatever, just put her down there, let her have her life. it was great. It's a wonderful ending. Like I said, I you know, there's certainly more minutiae we could dive into with this thing. I think there's some really, really banger shots. There's some really, really great action filmmaking here. Some incredible special effects when the aliens are sort of using their telekinesis to fling things, just done very smartly, very intelligently, very, very budget consciously, if we want to put it that way. But, you know, built around a stellar performance from Caitlin Dever and some really, really stellar direction by Brian Duffield. I think this film is one of, it may now be one of my favorite alien abduction type films. Like it just, I could see this being a go-to for the time being if I want something like that. Because apart from things like Fire in the Sky, you know, the X-Files movie gets there a little bit, even though it's very silly. You know, this kind of hits those notes for me in just the right way. And I don't know, it's become a pretty rapid fave and one that I've been consistently recommending to people. We were visiting some family not too long ago and they have Hulu and I was like, oh, have you watched this yet? And they were like, no, I don't even know what that is. And so I kind of pulled it up and showed it to them. I was like, you guys need to check this out. It's really good. And I see myself doing that in the future. At this point, Duffield is become one of my filmmakers and writers to watch because I really like Underwater a lot. Actually, I like that. I've watched that movie like 3 or 4 times now. It's not, you know, a favorite, but some of those sequences are really solid. And I like, you know, I'll go ahead and say it seems like Duffield has a pretty good handle of having really solid female heroines, right? Really, really interesting, engaging, awesome women at the center of his stories. Cause Spontaneous is also, a woman in the lead. Jane's Got a Gun, obviously. So it is just, it, you know, I'm definitely not one to say it takes a real man to write a woman. You know, I don't want to do that because that's dumb. But, you know, not unlike, you know, our boy Jimmy C, you know, some writers and directors just when JC's on the scene, baby. But, you know, like sometimes, especially when it comes to action writers, you know, and again, I'm not saying that they're the only ones, but there are certainly those directors out there that just know what it means to create a badass woman protagonist, right? Yeah. You know, like Sarah Connor will go down as one of the most awesome woman protagonists of all time. Ripley is, for me, the most awesome woman protagonist. That series, I just recently rewatched Alien Covenant and Prometheus, and those movies are so desperate to create another Ripley, like desperate, that I feel bad for Noomi Rapace and Catherine Watterson that they had to be in that role.
Yeah,
because it's like, you just ain't gonna get there. Like, I'm sorry, you're just not gonna get there. And I'm glad people are. I mean, I want them to try, but man, I just don't think people really understand how to make it work. And Duffield seems to have some chops there. Cause like I said, Deaver's character here, badass. Jane's Got a Gun, badass. Like it's kind of cool. It's really neat. And I hope, like, this is the kind of guy that I think, instead of Neil Blomkamp being given the chance to make an Alien movie, like, you know, fuck off back to South Africa, Neil. Give it to this guy. Let him give it a shot. See what he can do, right?
Just do something. Do something else.
I'm worried about that TV show. There's an Alien TV show coming, and I'm concerned.
I
just don't know.
I mean, I've talked about this before. I just think that we should take a break. Just pack it in, you know. Maybe like don't make one of these for like a decade and just see what happens. Just see how it goes. And then we'll come back, you know, if we're still here in like 10, 20 years, and maybe try again.
Sure. Yeah.
Same with all of the other franchises. Just like let's take a break. I've seen enough.
I'm gonna read this to you because this is gonna be a Noah Hawley show, right? So the guy did Legion, the guy's done Fargo. He's a great showrunner. Noah Hawley is a fantastic runner of television programs. For the most part, he wrote some episodes of Bones that weren't very good. But that's okay. That's fine.
Why have I seen every episode of that show?
Because it's a good show.
Riddle me that. Why did I watch that
show? It's a good show. Great premise, perfect procedural setup.
I think David, it's because I like the dude who plays Angel. I just love that guy.
He's very attractive, man.
I like that he's sassy.
He is atypically sassy.
And I really like that a main character had autism, and it's like, she's cool. I don't know. I always thought she was cool. Anyway,
so
tell me about the shitty Alien show.
Alien is an upcoming science fiction. This is just straight from Wikipedia. There's no reason to do anything else. Written and directed by Noah Hawley, based on the Alien franchise, it will serve as a prequel. And it will be set 3 decades before the events of the 1979 film Alien. Okay, so here's the cast. Sydney Chandler as Wendy, a metahuman with the body of an adult and the consciousness of a child.
Oh.
Okay. okay.
So, okay. So she will be born sexy yesterday, right?
Man, I hope not, but it's possible.
You know that's what they're going to do.
It's...
Because you don't write those words if that's not what you're going to do. You would find another way to say that.
I want to know what they mean by child. Like, is she 6 in the body of an adult? Because if so, that's gross. That's weird. But Timothy Oliphant is in it, and he's playing a synth, which that sounds good. That sounds fun. But he's a trainer and a mentor for Wendy. So I'm like, what? I don't know. Anyway, I'm not going to read anything else because it's all very disheartening.
It's just going to upset me, isn't it?
I don't know, man. I'm not going to say it's bad just because it's an alien thing and all alien things are now bad. But God,
most of them are, to be fair.
They're so bad. She did play the character, the lead of this series, Sydney Chandler, did play Violet in Don't Worry, Darling, which does not inspire confidence. Anywho.
But you know what? This movie was good. This alien movie was good.
This was about
aliens, and it nailed it.
That's right. And it didn't have to even have facehuggers or anything.
Yeah.
Nailed it. I know we went down a little tangent there, but this is one of the better, like, you know, alien abduction character fighting against the forces of an alien invading race. It's up there with me, you know, like I'm a big fan of the 70s body snatcher, even the 90s body snatcher, the weird one with Gabriel Anwar is pretty good. You know, like I like those. But this one, I think it's slick. It's well made. The conceit about not having dialogue works super well, and it's just very fun. I don't know, man. This is a big recommend for me. I think this is one of my favorite films of the year. Like, this is definitely probably in my top 5, pretty easily. And it just came out of nowhere, which I love it when they just come out of nowhere. Where it just shows up. And I go, that looks interesting. And I watch it and I'm like, hell yes, this is great.
I have.
And this absolutely was that for me.
I have noticed that, like, the less I engage with, you know, coming soon stuff on the internet, generally the better it goes when I actually sit down to watch a movie. Like, the less I know, the better. And I knew nothing about this. You just said, you got to watch this movie. It's great. and it was great. I had a great time.
It's great. It's literally.
I would like to see more stuff like this.
I think we're moving. I think we need to move away. Traditional forms of marketing are dead. And these, like, long tail buildups where it's like, we'll see a trailer 18 months out, then we'll see a slightly longer trailer 12 months out, and then we'll see like a final trailer 3 months out. Like, I think that just needs to go away. Like, that model doesn't, I don't think people have those kinds of long-term memories anymore. I think there is hype that can be built, but if you look at what's okay, like, we'll go back to Marvel for a second. Like, the reason why everybody's pissed at Marvel is because Marvel announced their next like 35 movies 3 years in advance. And now that life happened, and all that shit's been pushed back, and all these terrible things have happened. It's like, is the Blade movie coming? Shrug. Is Fantastic Four coming? Shrug. You know, is Kang coming? Nope. Because that guy's going to jail. But yeah, it's like, if they hadn't said anything, nobody could be mad. Yeah. Right? And if they just waited until like more shit was done, like they put Mahershala Ali at the end in the stinger of the Eternals, which now came out 3 years ago. They gave him one voiceover line to be like, yeah, Blade's coming, baby. Blade. And then now that movie's gone through like five directors and six screenwriters, and it's nowhere close to being made. And we're probably still not going to see it for another like three fucking years. It's like, yeah. Okay, guys, you really need to slow down and you need to think about shit. Right.
Well,
just show a trailer a month before the thing comes out.
But like now this is an entire subset of the film industry, of every industry. We do it with games, we do it with movies, we do it with television shows, where you have teams of people who are dedicated to building hype years out from something actually being completed or even started.
The GTA 6 trailer just dropped.
Yeah.
And it ends by saying it'll be out in 2025. Which means holiday 2025, which means it's 2.5 years away.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what?
And I get it. I get how that happens. And I understand now that because we have created this need, we have created this part of the industry, now there are people whose livelihoods depend on it. And as much as I want to say, like, oh, we should just stop doing this, can we stop doing it? Like, are we too far gone? Like, will we ever be able to stop this cycle that we have started?
I don't know. It's weird. You know, like, the entertainment industry needs buzz and hype. Like, it's built into the fabric of that industry because that's how you get pre-ticket sales and that's how you get people in for the first weekend. You know, like, the idea of a long tail theatrical release where, you know, we're not necessarily excited about, you know, the long-term health and life of this thing. You know, we just need that first weekend to hit hard. I think it's just something that's not sustainable. And the audiences of today, I don't think necessarily are going to respond to that kind of hype building in the ways that they have traditionally. Certainly they will. I mean, I'm still out here being like, oh, I'm excited about opening weekend, but I just don't get that feeling from people anymore. Like, oh, I got to see this. I mean, obviously we saw some examples of it this year with, like, you know, Barbenheimer, you know, that got people out to go, but that was like this whole weird, like, combo marketing thing and, you know, sort of playing on the industry's own tendency to do, you know, alternative programming on big release weekends. So I don't know. I don't know if that was like something, well, we already saw them try to do it again with Paw Patrol and Saw 10, which was kind of hilarious. The Saw Patrol weekend is what they tried to do with it, which just like, okay, those are a little too different, I think, guys. But yeah, like it's just something I've been thinking about a lot. Like, would it be better to stealth release a movie, right? To just like drop the trailer and say, you can go see this shit tomorrow, right? Like, would that be an experiment worth doing? I mean, it seems to work on streaming in some cases. Obviously, this one got no hype, but that's because Disney doesn't give Fox any money for advertising. Yeah. So that's probably why.
I mean, if we change to a model like that, I would like that. I mean, I kind of miss the days when I would show up to a movie theater and I would just pick something. And it kind of didn't matter if I knew anything about it, because it's like, I just want to see a movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that this cycle has hurt that a lot. And it's okay if we find some other way to do it, but I don't know. This all just feels like everyone is set up for disappointment all the time.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, there's only so much that you're going to be able to get, you know, only so much hype is going to get you at the end of the day. Okay, I did want to say I'm poking around on Wikipedia about Sydney Chandler, the lead of that Alien series. She's Kyle Chandler's daughter.
Oh.
What was that show he did? The newspaper show? Morning Edition? Early Edition?
Early Edition.
Early edition. There we go.
I enjoyed that show.
Same.
Half a season that it actually aired. It
survived for like 6 months. That's cool. I like Kyle Chandler a lot. So the fact that it's his kid, it's his little Nepo baby, maybe that's okay. Who knows?
I mean, I don't like nepotism. I think it's more bad than it is good. But, he seems like a... I don't know anything about him.
No.
He's in a lot of movies.
Dude, it says on Wikipedia, Early Edition ran for 4 seasons.
The fuck it did.
Get out of here.
It did 90 not.
Episodes? No.
Where is it?
Well, I certainly didn't watch it that long.
I only remember like 5 episodes of that show. He get the newspaper.
I remember the first season pretty well, but I definitely didn't remember going for 4 years. 90 episodes, dude. That's 25 a season. That's insane.
That's got to be a lie.
Yeah. The internet's lying. The
internet's fucking lying again.
Wikipedia's wrong. Wow. Crazy. Yeah, I'm going to have to try and hunt that down. I want to see what would the later seasons be? Like at some
point. He's still getting the newspaper.
Does he stop getting the newspaper at some point? He's got to go like find it or something. I don't. Anyway. All right. Well, I think we can wrap it up. Like I said, we've mused about many aspects of the film industry today for fun and pleasure. But this is a great movie. No One Will Save You. I wish the title is great. I love titles like No One Will Save You, but it's a bit on the word soupy, unmemorable side, right? It's a hard one to give to somebody and know that they're going to remember it. And it doesn't necessarily, I mean, it definitely plays into Bryn's mindset. Like she is fighting for herself, knowing that no one else is going to help her. Like there's no one she can go to. So it certainly is thematically accurate, but I don't know. I feel like maybe they could have workshopped the title a little bit more just
given
to make it something a bit punchier.
Many of these small horror movies have titles like that. I think it's always better to go with something shorter, something that stands out.
Sure.
Because the multi-word kind of sentence title, that's how I like to think of it. Like it's a title, absolutely. It's a complete sentence. Those are just so trendy right now.
Very much so.
And I don't know. I'm already tired of it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it comes in waves. We've talked about that many times. But it's just, it's one of those, like, we were never here. We never left. Like, there's just so many of these.
You should have left. We never left.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of them. So a minor complaint, but yes, very much a recommend from me. Sounds like from you as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So, if you've got Hulu, it's just there for you, man. If you don't have Hulu, you could get the Disney Plus bundle and get access to Hulu content right there in the Disney Plus app.
Or you could just steal it.
Or you could just pirate it. Yeah, you definitely.
Not that we're endorsing.
I would never advocate for such a thing.
Never. I would never download a car.
Nope.
I mean, I would. Maybe. I would.
The IT crowd.
You can steal a police officer's hat. His hat
and shit in it. And then give it to his wife. Yeah, that's it, definitely. All right, well, that'll do it for this week. So if somebody wants to find you online and follow all of your hot tips about UFO discoveries, where can they do that?
I post a lot of alien autopsy clips on my Twitter. With Baskinator. I'm still on Twitter. I'm still calling it Twitter. I'm on all the other social websites too, though. So, you want to talk, you can find me.
Same. So you can get me at TBaskin on X/Twitter. I'm also on Blue Sky under the same name, I do believe. So you can find me on there. And you can always get us at F-Piece Theater on X/Twitter as well. Or you can email us at failurepiece@gmail.com. We'll be back with another discussion of hopefully a fun film that you may or may not have heard of next time. But thanks for listening. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.